Isaiah chapter 34 and 35. Isaiah chapter 34 and 35. These two chapters hang together in Isaiah like two sides of a coin. That's why we're going to spend the time this evening reading both. So let us hear the word of our God. Draw near, O nations, to hear, and give attention, O peoples. Let the earth hear, and all that fills it, the world and all that comes from it. For the Lord is enraged against all the nations, and furious against all their host. He has devoted them to destruction, has given them over for slaughter. Their slain shall be cast out, and the stench of their corpses shall rise. The mountains shall flow with their blood. All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall, as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. For my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I have devoted to destruction. The Lord has a sword. It is sated with blood. It is gorged with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen shall fall with them, and young steers with the mighty bulls. Their land shall drink its fill of blood, and their soil shall be gorged with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into sulfur. Her land shall become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. But the hawk and the porcupine shall possess it. The owl and the raven shall dwell in it. He shall stretch the line of confusion over it, and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there is no one there to call it a kingdom, and all its princes shall be nothing. Thorns shall grow over its strongholds, nettles and thistles in its fortresses. It shall be the haunt of jackals, an abode of ostriches. And wild animals shall meet with hyenas. The wild goat shall cry to his fellow. Indeed, there the night bird settles and finds for herself a resting place. There the owl nests and lays and hatches and gathers her young in her shadow. Indeed, there the hawks are gathered, each one with her mate. Seek and read from the book of the Lord. Not one of these shall be missing. None shall be without her mate. For the mouth of the Lord has commanded, and his spirit has gathered them. He has cast the lot for them. His hand has portioned it out to them with the line. They shall possess it forever. From generation to generation they shall dwell in it. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute shall sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, where they lie down, The grass shall become reeds and rushes. And a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. I mentioned earlier the Chibok girls, 276 of them, who were kidnapped in April 2014 by Boko Haram in the town of Chibok in northern Nigeria. The girls are professing Christians and have been in captivity for over 2 years. Some have escaped, but 219 remain in the Sambisa forest. In June 2014, Islamic State began an ethnic cleansing of different people groups in regions in Iraq, Syria, and Libya. In particular, they targeted the Yazidi people of Iraq and Christians in Iraq and Syria. Their persecution and violence against the Yazidi people and Christians drove them into exile. In February 2016, the European Union recognized that the persecution of Christians by Islamic State was genocide. This was followed by the United States and then the British government. But to date, Islamic State has not been brought to account. Now, these are just two examples, and only two examples, of the persecution that God's people face in different parts of the world on a regular basis. In Sudan, Pakistan, India, China, North Korea, Somalia, to name only a few places, Christians are persecuted for their faith. They are beaten, imprisoned, exiled, in many cases killed. In many ways, this should not surprise us, because since the fall, God's people have always been a persecuted people. God, in fact, told the serpent and Eve that he was putting enmity between them and between their respective offsprings. And that's what we see in the rest of the Bible story. We see fighting between the devil's people and God's people. We see persecution, harassment, violence, and killing of God's people by the devil's people. You see it in Cain against Abel. You see it with the kings kidnapping Lot. You see it with Esau's bloodthirsty desire to murder Jacob in order to get his birthright back. You see it in the way Joseph's brothers sent him as a slave to Egypt. You see it with Israel in Egypt being brought under slavery. You see it with the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites fighting against Israel and Judah. You see it with Assyria and Babylon invading the lands of Israel and Judah and carrying God's people off into exile. We see it in the life of our Lord. Judas, the Pharisees, the Romans, Herod, Pilate, they persecute and eventually crucify Jesus. And we see it in the lives of Jesus' followers. No sooner has the New Testament church been formed in Acts, and what do we see happening? Persecution, beatings, imprisonment, murder. And it's no different for Christians today. We are still an exiled and persecuted people in a hostile world. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. Genesis chapter 3, 15 stands as a towering text which casts its shadow over the rest of the Bible storyline. Biblical history unfolds within one verse. Redemptive history inhabits the world of Genesis 3:15, of enmity. And in the midst of such enmity, in the midst of persecution, what do Christians long for? What do they want? vindication, justice, freedom. They want to go home. They want to be delivered. They want a day of shalom, of peace. They want their world restored. Isn't that what the Chibok girls will want tonight in the Sambisa forest? Isn't that what the Syrian and Iraqi Christians will want tonight as they sleep in tents, on mountains, and in refugee camps? They long for peace to restore persecution. And that's what Isaiah chapters 34 and 35 give us. They give us God coming to rescue his people in judgment and salvation. Remember what we've been seeing in Isaiah? Isaiah is the gospel of in the Old Testament. It's the Romans of the Old Testament. Isaiah is about the gospel story of how God saves his people through judgment for the transformation of the world. How he saves his people through judgment for the transformation of the world. The judgment on Judah was seen in the invasion of the Assyrians, then the Babylonians who take them into exile. Judah's salvation was seen in their return from exile out of Babylon back to the land of Canaan. In other words, God saves his people through judgment in order to transform the world. But Judah's salvation, their return from exile, also included God's judgment on the surrounding nations, especially those nations which had taken Judah into exile. God's judgment first fell on Judah for their sin, and then it fell on the surrounding nations for how they treated Judah. Just like in the gospel, God's judgment falls on Jesus for our sin, but then his judgment also falls on those who crucified him for how they treated him. Well, it was the same for Judah. They had received God's judgment at the hand of their enemies. God had taken them into exile. But then God promised to come and judge their enemies for how they treated them, and so rescue them out of exile. And that's what we have here in Isaiah 34 and 35. In chapter 34, we have God's judgment on the nations, especially those involved in taking them into exile. In this case, Edom. And then in chapter 35, we have God's salvation of Judah. Their return to the land. It's judgment, salvation. Remember the two-beat rhythm of Isaiah. Judgment, salvation. Except this time, it's not judgment experienced by Judah. It's judgment experienced by their enemies in order to save Judah. That's why you have to read these two chapters side by side. Two sides of a coin. You can't have one without the other. Because in order for Judah to experience salvation, true, complete salvation, their enemy must experience complete destruction. It's a bit like the Chibok schoolgirls. If they just escape from the Boko Haram men, they won't necessarily find true peace. Why? Because the men might return. What would give the Chibok girls true, lasting peace? For Boko Haram to be completely destroyed. That's when they would feel lasting peace. And it's the same for Judah. Their salvation involved judgment on their enemies. Because only when their enemies were completely destroyed could they be completely at rest, at peace. Only then could they find shalom. This is where these chapters about judgment and salvation serve a pastoral purpose. Look at chapter 34, verse 8. In the midst of a chapter of judgment on the enemies of his people, here's the comfort, verse 8. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And then look at chapter 35, verse 3 and 4. In the midst of a chapter about salvation for God's people, here's this pastoral application. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not, Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Do you see what's at the heart of comfort for an exiled and persecuted people in both passages? Vengeance. Have you ever thought of vengeance as a comfort? We tend to recoil from that, don't we? Aren't we meant to turn the other cheek? Aren't we meant to love our enemies? Well, yes, on a personal level. But in the end, if our enemies will not repent, if they will not turn to Christ and stop persecuting us, then what they deserve for all their hatred and persecution is judgment, vengeance. But notice whose judgment? God's. It's God's vengeance, not ours. We are never to seek personal vengeance, not because vengeance is wrong, but because it's not ours to seek. It's God's. God will repay every person who has done wrong to his people. And that vengeance is announced as a comfort to his exiled and persecuted people. And in Isaiah chapter 34 and 35, Isaiah brings two pieces of comfort to his people. First, God's everlasting judgment is coming on our enemies. God's everlasting judgment is coming on our enemies. That's chapter 34. Isaiah conveys this with a graphic picture. The world becomes a bloody desert. The world becomes a bloody desert. As we move through these verses, what we're going to see is we're going to see the world, the nations, become like a bloody desert. Isaiah starts with the whole world in verses 1 to 4, and then he moves to the nation of Edom as representative of the world in verses 5 to 17. Let's look at the world, verse 1 and 2. Draw near, O nations, to hear, and give ear, O peoples. Let the earth hear, and all that fills it, the world, and all that comes from it. For the Lord is enraged against all the nations, and furious against all their host. He has devoted them to destruction and given them over for slaughter. This is the end time judgment of the nations, and it's described in graphic terms of a bloodbath. Verse 3. Their slain shall be cast out, and the stench of their corpses shall rise. The mountains shall flow with their blood. Now, this isn't literal. It is a picture. It's a symbol of a coming judgment that is horrific. It's a picture of death, verse 3. Blood will flow. And it's a picture of cosmic disintegration, verse 4. All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall, as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. The whole universe will crumble as God comes in judgment. The sun, the moon, and the stars, that's the hosts of heaven. They'll fall like the autumn leaves off a tree. The skies will burn up like a piece of paper in the fire that rolls back as you put it in. This whole universe will crumble. The mountains will flow with blood. The final judgment is a picture of death and disintegration. And then Isaiah moves from the world and the nations to talking about one nation, Edom. Do you see that in verse 5? My sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. It descends for judgment upon Edom. Now, why does Edom get selected here? Well, sometimes in the Old Testament, the prophets pick out a nation and announce God's judgment on them in order to set them up as an example of what's going to happen to all the nations. Isaiah did it earlier with the nation of Moab, and here he does it with the nation of Edom. But there's more to why he chose Edom. Because Edom represents the most bitter enemy of God's people. Their last enemy. Let me explain what I mean. If you read biblical history, throughout the history of Israel and Judah, there is no other nation that is more hostile than Edom against Israel and Judah. It begins with Esau's bitter desire to seek revenge against Jacob, after he loses his birthright. And even though Esau and Jacob reconcile at the end of their lives, the old hostility raises its head in Esau's descendants. When Israel try to pass by their land, 400 odd years later, as they're coming out of Egypt to the promised land, Edom comes out and attacks them. And that pattern just continues throughout Israel and Judah's history. Saul goes to war with Edom. David fights Edom and subdues them. A little sort of anticipation of what the Messiah will do with mankind. Solomon experiences an Edomite rebellion. So do two more kings, Jehoroam and Amaziah. Edom is constantly fighting Israel and Judah, all the way up to the exile. When the Babylonians come in 587 to destroy Jerusalem and take people off as exiles, who's there helping them? The Edomites. And then when Judah goes into exile, Edom starts to migrate back into the southern part of Judah's land, the Negev. It's as if Esau has returned, grasping for his birthright, the land. So throughout the history of God's people, Edom is a constant enemy, the most bitter of all of Israel's enemies, and their last enemy before they went into exile. They were the Boko Haram, the Islamic State of the modern world for Christians in Africa and the Middle East. They were Judah's most bitter and last enemy. And the details of their destruction here are graphic, to say the least. This is 18 plus rated material. It starts with a lot of blood in verse 5 to 7, and then it moves to the imagery of a desert after a fire in verses 9 to 17. The blood is a sign of death, and it comes from the Lord's sword, verse 5. My sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Now, sword fighting, as you know in movies, is about person-to-person combat. And here it speaks of God's personal attack on Edom, in which he exacts individual punishment. The sword falls from heaven in a kind of arc movement and finds its target in Edom. And the description is rather graphic. Verse 6, the Lord has a sword. It is sated with blood. It is gorged with fat. There's this slaughter of Edom. And then it's described as a sacrifice in Bozrah. That's Edom's capital. Now, what is going on there? A slaughter that becomes a sacrifice to God. Well, sacrifices were about giving God what was due to him. And that's what this slaughter of Edom will be, giving God what is due to him. In this case, letting him be seen as the righteous judge who punishes those who persecute his people. We see that in verse 8. There's going to be this slaughter that is a sacrifice to Bozrah to God, verse 8. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. As I said earlier, here's the pastoral application. Here's the pastoral perspective on this judgment. It is not judgment for judgment's sake. It is judgment for God's people's sake. God is coming in judgment on his enemies for the cause of his people. He loves his people. He wants to preserve his people. He wants to save his people. And so he will come and avenge those who persecuted his people. This is Genesis chapter 12, verse 2, being played out. Those who curse you, Abraham, I will curse. This is world history. If you curse God's people, you will be cursed. And then the picture moves from a sword fight with lots of blood to a parched desert after a fire. Verse 9 gives us the fire. And then verse 10 shows us that it's going to be eternal. Night and day it will not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation, Edom shall lie waste. And in order to underscore the point that this is an eternal punishment, an eternal judgment, Isaiah tells us of who's going to come into the land, the new residents. Now, when a nation in the ancient Near East was destroyed or defeated, they would be taken into exile or they would all be killed. And over time, another nation would come in and settle. Another people would migrate in and settle. But look at the surprise. Who is it that comes in to settle in Edom's land? It's not another nation. It's not another people. It's animals. Desert animals. Here's the irony. Death for the people of Edom, but life for animals. Hawks and porcupines, jackals and ostriches, wild animals and hyenas, wild goats and birds, all desert animals. The picture is slightly ironic. Usually you see these kind of animals walking on their own, scavenging for food. But here they have mates. They come in packs. And the permanence of their habitation is seen in verse 14 and 15. They have mates. They have nests. They have broods of young. So no place for people, verse 10. No place for princes, verse 12. But a permanent place for animals. Animals will thrive in Edom's land. Verse 16 and 17. Seek and read from the book of the Lord. Not one of these animals shall be missing. None shall be without her mate. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken and his spirit has gathered them. God has cast the lot for the animals. His hand has apportioned it out to the animals with the line, the animals shall possess it forever and ever. From generation to generation, desert animals shall dwell in Edom. Do you see the picture? Permanent desolation and destruction for Edom. No return to their land. No new exile for Edom. This is an everlasting punishment. And this is God's first point of comfort to Judah. Do you remember? The book of Isaiah is addressed to Judah and Jerusalem. And this is God's comfort to his exiled and persecuted people. God's everlasting judgment is coming on our enemies. The world and our bitterest enemies will become like a bloody desert forever. It's a picture of death and disintegration. Boko Haram, an Islamic state, might at this moment be ruling in parts of Nigeria and Syria and Iraq. The Chibok girls might be in exile in the Sambezi forest. Syrian and Iraqi Christians might be living in tents, in mountains and refugee camps. But in the end, these persecutors will know only death and disintegration, because God will come to deal with them personally. He's coming in judgment on our enemies. That's the first word of comfort. The second word of comfort is chapter 35. God's everlasting salvation is coming to us. His everlasting judgment is coming on our enemies. His everlasting salvation is coming to us. And here Isaiah gives us another picture. In chapter 34, it was the picture of a world becoming a bloody desert. Here, it's the picture of a desert becoming a blossoming garden. Look at verse 1 and 2. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. While God's enemies will experience death and disintegration, God's people will experience life and rejuvenation. Here's the judgment salvation drumbeat. The enemies are judged, God's people are saved. Look how Isaiah personifies the desert. The desert begins to sing and to rejoice to the beat of salvation. He pictures the desert as a flower blossoming. those three named places, Lebanon, which is probably Mount Hermon, which had snow on it most of the year round, so it was always irrigated. Carmel was a place of luxuriant vegetation and growth, and so was Sharon. From wilderness plains to botanic gardens. That's the picture of salvation here. But that's not what will occupy the exiles after the judgment. That's not what they're going to fix their eyes upon. Look at verse 2. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of God. God is who they will see in this salvation. And look at verse 4. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. And this is why, as exiled and persecuted Christians, we are to strengthen our hands for action, to firm up our weak knees for stability, to confirm our anxious hearts for faith, because God is coming to seek vengeance. And in that moment of vengeance, look what he will do, verse 4, he will come and save us. And now Isaiah gives us two more pictures. A picture of renewed bodies, verse 5 and 6. And then he returns to the picture of a renewed world, verse 6 and 7. Renewed bodies are seen with our eyes, ears, legs, tongues being restored to their normal function. A renewed world is seen in the water breaking forth to irrigate a desert and rejuvenate vegetation. And the two go together, a renewed world for a renewed people. We will be restored as physical beings because the world will be restored. That's what the four is for in verse 6. Do you see that? The eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, and the lame shall leap, and the tongue of the mute shall sing for joy. Why? Why will we be physically restored? Because the world will be physically restored. For waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. If God is going to renovate the world, then he might as well renovate the people who are going to live in it. It's the order of creation, isn't it? God first made a world and a garden, and then what did he do? He made people to live in it. And that's what's going on here. The fall ruined us. It ruined the world. And here is God in salvation, restoring us and restoring us in a renovated world. Jesus, in his ministry, gives us a glimpse of this. His miracles were a foretaste of this salvation to come. When John the Baptist was in prison and he was unsure if Jesus was the Messiah, Jesus told John's disciples, "Tell John, the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame leap, and the mute speak." What was Jesus saying to John? John, you may be in prison, but let me tell you, outside of prison, let me tell you what's happening. A new world is dawning. This is a foretaste of heaven to come, John. It was breaking into history in the ministry of our Lord. All his healings are pointing to this moment of redemption, of salvation from our enemies. And all of this is so that we might find happiness in God. You see how the chapter ends in verse 10? And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. That's where the passage ends. Eternal happiness. But look how we get there. Verse 8. On a highway. And there shall be a highway there. It shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not wander onto it. This highway recalls the Exodus when Israel came out of Egypt. It recalls, or it explains for Judah, how they would get from Babylon back on a road, on a highway. But notice the word, the name of the highway. Just as we have names for highways, the M1, the M11, here's a name for this road that they will travel. It's called the Way of Holiness. The way into Babylon was the way of sin. That was the highway they walked on, if you like. But here, they're going to walk back to God on the way of holiness. Because to travel to God is to travel on the way of holiness. No unclean thing will walk on that way. No fool will wander onto the way. It's going to be sinless. But it's also going to be safe. Verse 9. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there. So there's no danger on it. But look who will be found on the road. Not lions, but people. The redeemed shall walk there. When we want to go on a toll road, you have to pay. If you want to go on a toll road, you only get on it if you pay. Well, that's the same with the way of holiness. It's like a toll road, but with a difference. You only get on it if someone else pays for you. That's what the word redeemed means. It's the idea of a next of kin voluntarily paying a price to bring you into the family. It's Boaz paying for Ruth in order that he might marry her and bring her into the family. And it's a picture of our Lord Jesus, our Redeemer, our next of kin. He became one of us in order to pay a price to bring us back into the family. And that's who gets to walk on the road. Not people who pay themselves onto the road, but people who have been paid onto the road by someone else. The redeemed shall walk on the road. People who have been bought at the price that someone else has paid. And again, look where it leads us. To happiness. To everlasting happiness. People often think of holiness as boring. Righteousness as a drab. Perhaps as a young person here this evening, you think, holiness, righteousness, sanctification, it all sounds a bit drab, a bit boring. Well, don't believe that, because look at this passage. Holiness leads to happiness. As Alec Mateer puts it, to unbroken and unbreakable happiness. Do you see that? Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. The Chibok girls in the Sambesa forest right now know only unbroken and unbreakable sadness and trauma. The Christians from Syria and Iraq right now know only unbroken heartache and unbreakable distress. But one day, they will go to Mount Zion with singing. Can you hear them? The Chibok girls singing on that day with everlasting joy. But not their tormentors. They will know only unbroken and unbreakable torment. Chapters 34 and 35 of Isaiah is a picture of hell and a picture of heaven. And the question we have to ask ourselves tonight is, what is our destiny? Are we part of the people of God on the highway of holiness, heading for happiness, unbroken, unbreakable happiness? Or are we in Edom, awaiting death and disintegration, unbroken and unbreakable punishment?